Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello, everybody. This is Jay Shapiro. Thanks for listening. I want to touch upon three topics this week, and I use the expression touch upon because they cannot be discussed in detail in a short program, but they are important, and I want to raise them as thinking points for the listeners. The first is the population change that's now taking place in Europe. The Christian population is being replaced by a Muslim population, and unfortunately, in most cases, the Muslim population is not integrating into Europe. This is due to the large influx of Muslims from countries that have no history of liberalism nor Western values, and the Muslims are increasing at a much greater rate than the native Christian population, which is aging and not reproducing. This will affect the entire Western world and, of course, the European attitude toward Israel. That's one item. The second item that I want to touch upon is the terrorism being done by Israeli Arabs. Israeli Arabs are citizens of Israel who have the same voting rights as I do, and many are being brainwashed against the very state in which they live. And this terrorism is not being condemned by the Arab representation in the Israeli government. The existence of a hostile population in our very midst is a serious problem that has been unique to Israel, but is now beginning to appear in Europe also. And finally, I want to speak about semantic infiltration. Semantic infiltration is the repeated use of terms in order to establish mindsets. The latest example is the term occupation, which sounds terrible to the liberal mind, and it is a term that is now being used unfairly against Israel. These are the three topics I want to touch upon this time. Thanks for listening. I'll be back right after the break. Jay Shapiro here.
Hi, this is Heather Dean. Is your home sweet home just a place to hang your hat? Check out The Modern Jewish Home every Wednesday at 5 p.m. for practical advice from a wide variety of experts and innovators about relationships, getting organized, growing your business, nourishing your body and soul, and even having a good laugh. So make yourself at home every Wednesday at 5 p.m. Israel time on The Modern Jewish Home here on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again, Jay Shapiro here. Something very important is happening in Europe that will affect the future of Judeo-Christian civilization, and it's simply not getting enough attention. What's happening is that the population of Europe is changing radically because of two basic reasons. The Christian population is not increasing and is not even reproducing itself. The Christian families in Europe are having fewer children and not even enough children to simply replace the present generation. You need 2.1 kids per mother simply to replace the present generation, and all the European countries are below that. At the same time, the Muslim population is increasing rapidly by both immigration into Europe as well as the Muslim population already in Europe reproducing at a greater rate than the Christian population. and the Muslim population is by and large not integrating into the local population and not accepting the values and the mores of the local population, which is essentially Judeo-Christian civilization. This has tremendous implications not only on the future of Europe, but on the future of the relationship of Europe to Israel. I want to give some examples that I myself found surprising and disturbing, but I think that the listeners should be aware of them. What's happening is that a replacement of population is taking place in Europe that does not bode well for the future of Europe or for Europe's relationship with Israel or indeed for Western civilization, which, as I said, is Judeo-Christian. I don't want to bore the listeners with a lot of statistics, but bear with me because I want to use Italy as an example. In Italy is the center of this demographic earthquake, and it has become Europe's soft underbelly as hundreds of thousands of migrants arrive. In a recent three-day period this year, the number of migrants in 2017 exceeded 60,000, 40% more than the same period last year. Over the Easter weekend this year, thousands were rescued in the Mediterranean and brought to Italy. And that is just the tip of the iceberg. During this present summer, the number of arrivals just from Libya will increase tremendously. A replacement of population is underway in Italy, which is representative of what's happening in Europe in general. But if you open the mainstream newspapers, you barely find these figures. No television station has dedicated any time to what's happening, and apparently the governments are not allowing any criticism. This is essentially a quiet invasion. In 2016, eight times as many migrants came to Italy as in 2014. In 2015, there were 103,000. In 2014, 66,000. In 2013, 22. In the last 4 years, 427,000 immigrants reached Italy. In only the first 5 months of this year, Italy received 10% of the total number of migrants in the last 4 years. Now, the Italian Navy and the Italian Coast Guard rescued these boat people out of the Mediterranean for humanitarian reasons. The country is exhausted. There are, believe it or not, Italian villages where the majority is already made up of new migrants. And this is the beginning of what's happening all over Europe. It's a reflection. One of the major aspects of this revolution is taking place in a country which is dramatically aging. According to a new report, Italy's population will fall to about 53 million in half a century, which is a loss of 7 million people. Italy, which has one of the world's lowest fertility rates, will lose between 600,000 and 800,000 citizens every year. Immigrants will number more than 14 million, about one-fourth of the total population. So there are even more pessimistic scenarios in which the Italian population could drop to 46 million, or 14 million people less than now. That is a tremendous number. It's predicted that in 2050, a third of Italy's population will be made up of foreigners. This is, by the way, according to a UN report. 37% of the population is expected to be foreigners, one out of every three inhabitants in another 50 years. Now, what's aside from the change in the culture, because different people are now going to be the majority or a significant minority, there are other implications. For example, right now, immigrants, once registered, receive a monthly income of 900 euros per month, €30 per day for personal expenses. Another €900 go to the Italians who house them, and €600 are needed to cover insurance costs. Overall, every immigrant costs Italy €2,400 a month, which is interesting when you take into account that a policeman in Italy earns half of that sum, and a naval volunteer who saves the migrants receives a stipend of €900 a month. The cost of migrants on Italy's public finances is immense. It will destroy the possibility of any economic growth in Italy, which is not a particularly economically vibrant country at the moment. In 2017, this year, the government of Italy is spending €1.9 billion for pensions. But €4.2 billion for migrants and €4.5 billion for national housing plan, and much of this is for the migrants. You know, it's very interesting. Years ago, Winston Churchill was convinced that the Mediterranean was the soft underbelly of Europe. During the Second World War, he was in favor of an invasion of Europe, first through Italy or through the Balkans, because he called it the soft underbelly of Europe. That is Hitler's Europe. It's now become the soft underbelly of Europe's transformation into Eurabia. It's becoming more Muslim. By the way, there are a lot of people smugglers who are bringing the migrants to Italian seaports because they make money out of it. So apparently the mafia has economic interests in managing the migrants after their arrival, too, for all kind of personal reasons. Now, to sum it up, you cannot, for example, compare the migrants today to the Jews who were fleeing Nazism during the Nazi period. Pope Francis, for example, recently compared the migrants' centers to Nazi concentration camps, which is just a terrible comparison. Today, there are no gas chambers or medical experiments or crematory or slave labor or firing squads or forced marches. On the contrary, the migrants are living quite well. These comparisons are spread by the media for a precise reason. They want to shut down any debate about these migrants. So it's to sum it up, by 2065, it's expected that 14.4 million migrants will arrive. I'm talking only Italy. Added to the more than 5 million already there, 37% of the population in 2065 is expected to be foreigners, more than one out of every three inhabitants. And they're not simply going to be foreigners. I mean, they're going to have kids by that time, etc. They're going to people who come from a different culture, have no interest. Most of them have no interest in integrating into the local culture for a lot of reasons. And also because the locals are allowing this to happen. Now, this cannot have any positive effect on the future of Europe, nor can it have a positive effect on the future of relationship between Europe and Israel, for example. Nor, I guess, will it have any positive effect on the relationship between the United States and Europe. The United States now is going through the throes of a new administration that it wants to strengthen America vis-a-vis Europe. So we're living in extremely interesting times. There is a Chinese blessing. Well, you know what, when you want to say something nice to somebody, you say, "I hope you do not live in interesting times." Unfortunately for the Jews, this has not been true for several thousand years. We always live in interesting times. But now these interesting times are including in the entire Western civilization. And Israel is in the forefront of the struggle for the survival of that Western civilization. So here we went from a country just founded in 1948, a poor country, and now we are, they have the responsibility of being in the front line of the survival of Western society and Western culture. It's a big responsibility. I'll be back after the break.
Jew haters, beware. Political hitman is here. Who's in my crosshairs? Who's in my hot seat? I'm Howie Silberger. Join me Sundays at noon Eastern, 7 Israeli, and Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, 9 Israeli, for Political Hitman, only on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again, you're back with Jay Shapiro. One of the reasons that there is no two-state solution to our issues with the Palestinians is that the Palestinians are not interested in a two-state solution. They want to destroy Israel. They pay lip service to the two-state solution when they're speaking in languages other than Arabic, when they're speaking in French or German or Russian or what have you, English, to foreign listeners. The bottom line is not only that the leadership of the Palestinians encourages and rewards terrorism, but even their public response to terrorism reveals their true feelings and broadcasts these true feelings to their listeners. Terror incidents are unfortunately not a novel news item here in Israel. Unfortunately, we have had terror incidents going back more than 100 years. From the very beginning of the Zionist enterprise, there was terror against Jews for hundreds of years, actually. And you can check out the history. For example, if you go to Google and type in the words synagogues in the old city of Jerusalem, you'll find that the Muslims are very fond of burning down synagogues under all kinds of pretexts. Sometimes they pretended, for example, the Jews hadn't paid the mortgage. There is a synagogue in Jerusalem called the Churva, and it was built about 150 years or 200 years ago, and it was burned down by the Arabs, and then now it has been rebuilt. Churva means destruction, and it was rebuilt after the Six-Day War. It's a very beautiful synagogue now. But it was burned down before there was a state of Israel. It was something the Muslims were fond of burning, of doing. The situation became exacerbated at the end of the 19th century when Jews began to return to the Holy Land to build and to work in agriculture, as opposed to the previous times when Jews came here simply to learn Torah, to live in the Holy Land, and to die and be buried in the Holy Land. But when Jews came to build in the Holy Land, there was a nationalistic response. As a matter of fact, Arab nationalism came into being in response to Jewish nationalism. For example, Najib Azuri was a Christian Arab nationalist who wrote a book. By the way, he was in 1905. He had to run out of the country because he was a Christian, and he had to leave the country because the Ottoman authorities, who controlled Palestine at that time, put a price on his head because he was a nationalist. And the Ottoman authorities didn't like nationalism of any kind. And he wrote a book called The Awakening of the Arab Nation back in 1905. He wrote it. And I quote what he said. Two important phenomena of the same nature but nevertheless opposed, which have not yet attracted attention, manifest themselves at this time in Asiatic Turkey. Asiatic Turkey, by the way, meaning Palestine. Continuing to quote, these phenomena are the awakening of the Arab nation and the latent efforts of the Jews to reconstitute the ancient monarchy of Israel on a very large scale. These two movements are destined to fight each other until one prevails over the other. Upon the final outcome of that battle between these two peoples representing opposing principles, the fate of the entire world depends. Unquote. He wrote that back in 2005. And now what's happened is, as I said, we've become accustomed, unfortunately, to Arab terrorism. But something happened last week, which was pretty much of a little bit different than what's been happening before. Arabs with Israeli citizenship, they came from an Israeli Arab town called Umm al-Fahm. In other words, they're Israeli citizens means they have the same voting rights as I do. Arabs with Israeli citizenship smuggled guns into the holy site and desecrated a place designated for prayers by shedding the blood of two innocent human beings. These Arabs on the Temple Mount in Muslim services came out with guns and gunned down two Israeli policemen who happened, by the way, not to be Jewish. They were Druze. And the Arabs were, of course, shot down in a gun battle. But so now you would expect that the Palestinians would denounce this terrible thing, using a mosque, if you will, as a place to hide guns and come out and start shooting innocent people. But instead of denouncing this, the Palestinians and the broader Muslim world has pretty much focused on the security measures taken by Israel in response to the attack. In other words, they didn't condemn the attack. They condemned Israel for increasing the security measures on the Temple Mount. For example, Jordan's King Abdullah, who's supposed to be our friend, publicly criticized Israel's decision. The first thing Israel did when this happened was to block access to the Temple Mount. And the king was motivated, of course, by a need to demonstrate to the Jordanians, most of whom are of Palestinian origin, that he's taking a tough position against Israel. But he could have delayed his criticism, because it just wasn't necessary at that time. Entrance to the Western Wall area is possible only after undergoing a security check and passing through a metal detector. And by the way, that's only for the Jews. Arabs can, or Muslims, go up on a Temple Mount without being subject to these measures. So now it's obviously clear that a similar arrangement has to be put in place at the entrance to the Temple Mount. Otherwise, you're going to have the kind of thing what you had last week, where people hid guns away on the Temple Mount and came out and killed innocent people. Now, the truth of the matter is, if the leaders of the Palestinian Authority had invested as much time and energy to build a society, we'd be much better off instead of where they're investing all this in the pursuit of death and destruction. It's a shame, because it's a pity. It's only about a 30-minute drive from the compound in Ramallah where Abu Mazen sits to the Prime Minister's office in Jerusalem. Yet it seems it's easier for dignitaries in the United States and Europe to spend hours on airplane flights to Tel Aviv for the purpose of talking about a two-state solution. All the Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority has to do, or the President, is to come just take a trip to Jerusalem. It only takes less than a half hour. By the way, the Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority is a guy named Rami Abdallah, who last week, was a very interesting news item, that he launched the first ever Palestinian-owned power substation in Jenin, together with Israeli National Infrastructure, Energy, and Water Resources Minister Yuval Steinitz. Now, so here's a guy who sat down with an Israeli minister to talk about cooperation on power. And the same guy, Rami Hamdallah, vowed last month to continue rewarding terrorists. According to the Palestinian News, the Hamdallah said, "On behalf of Abbas and our Palestinian people, I salute all the martyrs' families and emphasize to them that their rights are protected. We remember the sacrifices and struggle of the pure martyrs, guardians of land and identity, who have turned our people's cause into a historical epic of struggle and resolve." In other words, the Prime Minister of Palestinian Authority, who sat down the previous week in cooperation with an Israeli minister about power, something Israel was helping them with, he got up and said, "No, we're going to continue to reward terrorists and their families with all kind of stipends and things that make their lives better." And by the way, this is true whether the martyrs are killed or whether they're in Israeli jails. And that what has been going on. And this is a very sad situation. That is why there is really no two-state solution, because the Arabs are simply not interested. And I've said before, and you know, I don't want to bore the listeners by repeating, unless and until the Palestinian Authority has a change in their educational system, and unless and until the preachers and the imams in the mosques stop preaching against the state of Israel and against individual Jews, there's simply no possibility of any kind of solution, let alone a two-state solution. We have a problem that I think the bottom line is it's going to have to be managed. And one of the ways it can be managed is by Israel overseeing the educational system in the Palestinian Authority. Because as long as kids are taught from kindergarten and in summer camps and in their entire education that the state of Israel has no right to exist, that even individual Jews who are unbelievers or disbelievers have no right to exist, there's no possibility of peace. So in other words, since the Palestinian Authority took over in 1994, they've raised at least two generations of kids who are now adults who have heard nothing except the state of Israel has no right to exist. So for the even if you change their educational system tomorrow morning, it's going to take a couple of generations when you can talk about any kind of peace with these people, let alone a two-state solution. That's the situation, and people have to realize this and stop bandying about a two-state solution, which is completely out of the realm of reality. The only thing it does is provide jobs for people who write papers and diplomats. I'll be back after the break.
I am Walter Bingham. For the past 12 years, I have each week brought you reports of life and events in Israel and the Jewish world and the news behind the news. The Walter Bingham File, new here on Israel News Talk Radio, will explain the truth to enable you to counter the myth that are spread by the world's media. So if you want to have the facts and without spin, then tune in to The Walter Bingham File every Sunday at 5 p.m. in Israel, 10 a.m. U.S. Eastern Time, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hi, you're back with Jay Shapiro. I want to say a few words about semantic infiltration. Semantic infiltration is a term introduced by the late senator from New York, Patrick Moynihan. He defines semantic infiltration as repetitive use of specific words to establish mindsets. It's a close cousin to the famous big lie used by Hitler's Minister of Propaganda. Repeat a lie long enough and loud enough, and it will be accepted by the truth as the truth. And they have all kinds of mantras, like using the word Palestinians to refer only to Arabs living in the area that was formerly the British Mandate, which gives the impression that these Arabs are native to the area while everyone else is an outsider or a usurper. This disregards the fact that most of the Arabs living here came after the beginning of Jewish resettlement at the end of the 19th century in order to take advantage of job opportunities that the Jews established. There are other mantras of semantic infiltration like West Bank, territory, refugees, settlements are an obstacle to peace, and so forth. And we could discuss all of these in detail, but the one I want to discuss today is a new one that's come up in the last few years. This newest term is called end the occupation. Although it's popular, few understand what it means. It could, for example, refer to what Israel conquered during the Six-Day War in 1967, or what Israel acquired during the War of Independence back in 1948, or everything from the river to the sea. Now, there has been a debate over territory. It's important, but it has limited effect because as Palestinian terrorism and incitement continued, and after two more Israeli withdrawals from southern Lebanon in 2000 and from the Gaza Strip in 2005, Israel was reluctant to surrender more territory. The land for peace mantra no longer persuaded anyone except perhaps hardline ideologues. Even Israelis who supported the two-state solution were unwilling to make further concessions. During the last decade, a new argument became prominent. It's also espoused by Israeli Jews and progressive Jews in North America who are indeed pro-Israel. The new mantra is the occupation. It's not only about territory, but it's about occupying the Palestinian people. The shift to a humanitarian argument is persuasive because it is presented as a moral issue. Israel has no right to control another people or another nation. That is the thought behind the occupation. This portrays Israelis as persecutors and the Palestinians as their victims. Therefore, even if the question of the legality of settlements is conceded, the alleged violation of human rights of the Palestinians remains as a moral issue. For example, critics charge that restricting where Palestinian Arabs can live or interfering with their daily lives and invading their towns and villages and violating their civil and human rights constitutes occupation. Ending that occupation is complicated because first, Palestinian terrorists pose a constant threat to Jews. Second, radical Islamists are involved. And three, withdrawal from Area C, which is where most of the Jewish settlements are, and creating a Palestinian state would promote terrorism. There's no two ways about it. In other words, ending the occupation as a humanitarian and moral issue cannot be accomplished without making territorial concessions, removing Israel's security control. And this link is crucial. The humanitarian argument is used to justify Palestinian demands for territory and a state. Israel's rational refusal to allow Palestinians to form an independent state becomes entangled in a moral argument over the right to self-determination, which sits very high on the agenda of liberal American Jews. The failure to understand the dynamic relationship between the humanitarian argument and Palestinian demands for territory has paralyzed Israel's attempt to justify its claims to the settlements. Therefore, Israel is trapped. As long as it refuses to grant Palestinians a state and holds on to Area C and maintains its anti-terrorism activities in Palestinian towns, it will be accused of occupation and persecution of Palestinians. Moreover, the occupation is used to justify terrorism and resistance on the part of the Arabs. End the occupation suggests an immediate and direct distinction between good and evil. Occupation sounds like a bad word. And it's most effective, this word, occupation. Regardless of the details, this mantra creates a psychological determinism that forces what you can could be an either-or decision. Once the premise that occupation is evil is accepted, then the conclusion is inevitable. It doesn't require much thinking, and it really prevents thinking. Ends the occupation means Israel is bad, and the Palestinians are victim. It's a form of brainwashing. Repeating mantras such as settlements prevent peace and Israel is a colonialist apartheid state make someone feel empathy and a sense of injustice. Whether or not it is true is simply irrelevant. End the occupation demands that Israel give up tangible assets like territory for intangible agreements like diplomatic recognition that are easily revocable. The most important refutation is that the first priorities of a state are to protect its population, preserve its society, and defend its borders. That's why all countries have armies, they have police forces, and they have prisons. Since Palestinians and Arabs seek to destroy Israel, Israel is morally obligated to its citizenry, morally and practically to defend itself. Capitulation and surrender to terrorism are not options. Also, a Palestinian state west of the Jordan River would not become a democratic peaceful regime or to resolve the problem of millions of Palestinians who live in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and other countries, including Israel. The danger is that a Palestinian state would be a failed state, and it would be run by gangs and militias. And we can see that already under the Palestinian Authority. There are already failed states like Somalia, and I think Syria is rapidly becoming a failed state. Finally, Arab Palestinians are not captives. Many of them, if perhaps not most of them, have Jordanian passports. They can move, and if they own land and property, they can sell it. Many, by the way, have done so and have been quite successful. As long as terrorism exists, there will be occupation. There will be checkpoints. There will be police interventions. And there will be long lines at airports. As a matter of fact, as long as terrorism exists, there are long lines at airports all around the world. Ending the occupation, this mantra, begins with ending incitement and hatred and ending terrorism. That's what it's about. By the way, ending the occupation doesn't only apply to Israel. There are dictatorships in many parts of the world, like this ISIS now that the West is fighting against. Ending the occupation could also apply to the Hamas rule in Gaza, the Hezbollah rule in Lebanon, Assad and ISIS in Syria, and also the Taliban in Afghanistan. There are a lot of occupations going on around the world. A lot of them are a lot of the occupiers are really bad people. End the occupation is not a call to protect Palestinian rights. What it really is a call to end Israel's existence. It's not a plea for humanity, but rather it's an invitation to mayhem and genocide, which is what the Palestinians claim themselves, only using Arabic, not when they speak English. End the occupation should be understood for what it is. It is a threat to the existence of the state of Israel. So, unfortunately, as I said in the beginning, there are a lot of terms that have been repeated over and over again so that their mindsets have been established. And end the occupation is a particularly insidious one because it sounds like it's being said for humanitarian reasons. When you're occupying somebody else, it's by definition bad. But these are the facts, and it's very important that all of these terms have become part of the conventional wisdom in an incorrect form. You have to understand what the implications are of these terms. Semantic infiltration, as I said, was defined by Senator Patrick Moynihan. It's being applied in many, many areas. But in Israel, it is a life and death issue. Ending the occupation sounds really nice, sounds very humanitarian. But the end, the so-called occupation, could bring an end to the state of Israel. And of course, we cannot allow that to happen. So I just wanted to share these thoughts with the listeners, because the end the occupation has become a very, very prominent mantra. And you hear it over and over again. It sounds great. It sounds very humanitarian. It is really exactly the opposite. It's a call for the end of the state of Israel. And certainly we cannot allow that. Until next time, Jay Shapiro, take care of yourself. I wish everyone a good week.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
This is Shai Ben-Tekoa, and each week I'll be webcasting to you from Judea, origin of the word Jew, a people besieged and beleaguered in every generation. Nazi Germany is but a memory, but in its place the world invented the phantom Palestinians as this generation's internationally authorized Jew killers. Tune in for a different slant on life in Israel, Phantom Nation, every Monday.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
If you're hearing this message, everyone else can too. Advertise with Israel News Talk Radio and get your message out to people. We'll build a personalized package for you. Contact advertising at israelnewstalkradio.com.
Straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.